Well, over 2 million households in Australia have experienced severe food insecurity in the last 12 months. That's regularly skipping meals or going entire days without eating at all. And in those homes struggling to put food on the table, there are 1.3 million children who are going hungry. So 1.3 million, that's the entire population of Adelaide. Sobering, huh? This week is Anti-Poverty Week, and every day we're going to look at a major factor contributing to poverty here in South Australia. Today we're going to take a look at food insecurity. Greg Patterson is Chief Executive of Food Bank SA and joins me now. Greg, that's a terribly sobering statistic.
It is, Caroline, and it's. I think everyone has known that there is an issue around food insecurity, and COVID, I think, if nothing else, taught us that it could happen to anybody. You know, the old stereotype where it is only afflicting people who are homeless or unemployed, I think has completely gone out the window now. And we now know that it could happen in any part of Adelaide and in any part of South Australia indeed. And it's happening on an increasing scale.
What's contributing to food insecurity in SA?
The principal cause, the over 60% of the people who are food insecure indicated that was cost of living, that rising cost of living is the main issue. So rising cost of fruit, food and grocery, we all know the impact that supply chain interruptions due to the floods and also labour shortages have had. Increased energy costs, I think everyone's, you know, we know the federal government is trying to do something around that, but it is a significant issue. And I think we were just told yesterday that South Australian electricity prices are expected to go up by just under 10% in the next few months. So that's going to be another hit. And then things like housing costs is the other one. Rent, aside from mortgages, there's rent increases that have occurred since about July. So all of that perfect storm has meant that there is an increased need. People are increasingly looking around for ways of trying to supplement their mm-hmm. food each week.
What have been the impacts of food insecurity when you're seeing it more broadly in the community?
What we're seeing is that we've got people now coming in to seek food assistance who have never ever needed to do so before. About 40% of the people that come in don't see themselves as being part of the charity sector. They've never needed to seek assistance. They don't necessarily need help on things like domestic violence. You know, they will likely may need assistance on things like budgetary control and financial assistance. But a lot of them are just saying, look, I don't have any issues. I just need food. And as the report, the hunger report showed, over half actually have jobs. And about 30% have mortgages. So it is not just that stereotypical people who there's perceptions of people wasting their money or things like that. This is not the case. These are people being very careful about their weekly spend, but just can't make it all add up right at this moment.
And Greg, does that mean that people are choosing between electricity, petrol, food, everything else?
I think so. There's people that there's food recipients of what we call episodic. They perhaps get an electricity bill, and then it's a case of, well, you know, we'll make sure the bills are paid, the roof's over our head, the kids are okay, but perhaps mum and dad don't eat this week, so they'll be coming to see us in those times just to try to get food to get by until they've got their next pay packet.
There's some alarming results in your hunger report, and people can definitely go online and have a look at that. I note mm-hmm. as well, though, your costs have had to go up to meet the need too. Isn't that right?
They have. We get a lot of food donations from the primary produce sector, from the farmers, from the food manufacturing sector, and from the retailers. But about a third of the food that we distribute, we actually have to buy ourselves. So things like meat and milk and rice and pasta and tinned fruit and vegetables. And just as the consumers have been hit with price increases, we have as well. So products that were 75 cents last year, milk, for example, was 75 cents last year that we could buy it at, is now at about $1.30. So all of those costs have impact on our ability to get the food that we need to meet the demand. And unfortunately, without us, you know, we can't just pluck money out of the air. We actually had to put our prices up for the first time in 8 years. So I regret to say that our food hubs in South Australia are actually the most expensive of any of the food hubs around Australia, because we are so reliant on our fundraising from corporate partners and things like that.
Well, look, we really appreciate the work you do. Thank you for your time, Greg Patterson, Chief Executive of Foodbank SA. Well, we have been focusing on anti-poverty this week. Today, we're talking about the cost of living, which is obviously one of the issues front of mind for everyone. If you're finding a little tough balancing the books, when it comes to the cost of living these days, there is free help that you might not know about. And Kate Fox is South Australian Financial Counsellors Association, or she's from the Financial Counsellors Association. Kate, thank you for joining us. The rising cost of living and the impact on people with low and middle income earners is at a high at the moment. Are you finding calls for your help has increased?
Absolutely. Yeah, look, the cost of living is impacting so many people, and people are turning to financial counsellors for help. And if any of your listeners don't know who a financial counsellor is or what they do, they are a free service offered through not-for-profit organisations that provide support and advice around how to manage finances, manage debts, negotiate debts, do all of those sorts of things to help out. So if anyone is looking for a financial counsellor, the best way to find one is to call 1-800-007-007, that's the National Debt Helpline, and they'll be able to point you in the right direction to find a service. Or if you want to look online, you can look at askiv.org.au. But yeah, what we're really finding now is that people who were actually managing okay aren't managing anymore because the cost of living has gone up so much. Food's gone up, petrol's gone up, rent's gone up. It's been really difficult for lots of people.
Are they the main reasons that you're seeing people come to you around those day-to-day costs and struggling to try and meet those?
Yeah, that is some of them. People come to or seek financial counselling for all sorts of reasons. Sometimes it's unexpected illness that's thrown them into crisis. It could just be they've really found themselves in a situation where they can't afford to keep paying particular debts. So people find themselves like taking out a lot of buy now, pay later loans that they can't afford to repay. And people are using them for things like food and electricity and or accounts that they wouldn't normally use them for. And then they get into this almost treadmill where they have to keep getting buy now, pay later to try and keep up with what they've put on there. So financial counsellors can help with that, and they might even be able to point them in the right direction for things like no-interest loans through Good Shepherd Microfinance and places like that.
Who are the kind of people, you know, that you're actually dealing with? What's an example of a situation of someone coming to you with a concern?
Yeah, look, financial counsellors have told me, we're not a financial counselling service as such, but financial counsellors have told me situations where they've had clients who've had to, or felt like they've had to choose between food and medication. So someone who had multiple life-saving medications that they needed to be on was trying to work out which one they couldn't take, which is, you know, obviously they worked out a way to support them through that. But just having to make those difficult decisions is really hard. And there was another example where there was a person who really, they were living in their car, they needed extra mental health medication, but they ran out of petrol, so couldn't get to the medical appointment. They got charged for the medical appointment because they didn't turn up. You know, it's just this cycle of things that just really impact people. And it doesn't have to be a large amount to impact those on the lowest of income. Sometimes those small costs can make a big difference. So it's been a really difficult time for many people.
Oh, absolutely. And Kate, I guess having somewhere or someone like yourself to speak to, or any one of the financial counsellors, is it just sometimes sitting down and being able to, you know, free yourself of what's going on and talking to someone who might be able to give you some solutions that makes all the difference?
Absolutely. And it is amazing that the work that financial counsellors do, so they do look at your whole situation, so they look at all the different bills and debts and and your personal circumstances and put them all together and come up with, like, they work with you about what's going to be the best outcome for you. So they take everything into account and they just help as much as they can. So they can even refer you to services such as tenancy support or legal services if that's required. So they're really good at making sure that they look at a holistic approach to supporting people.
And I guess if someone comes to you, you obviously have advice for them. Are you able to send them on into, you know, to different directions in terms of support that they might require in other places if that's needed?
Absolutely, yeah. Financial counsellors are really good at making warm referrals to other organisations and other services that can support people. And they do work in organisations that might have those services actually under the same roof. So some of the bigger not-for-profit organisations, they might be able to refer them to another service internally as well.
Well, important to know that there is help out there. Thanks so much for telling us about it. Kate Fox. That was Kate Fox there, Executive Officer for the South Australian Financial Counsellors Association. And that national debt hotline that Kate just mentioned at the start of our interview, 1-800-007-007 was the number to call. So that's 1-800-007-007 if you feel like you need to talk to someone about your financial situation. And each day this week, we'll be taking a look at one of the major factors contributing to poverty this Anti-Poverty Week. Well, this week we've touched on some of the aspects of poverty as part of Anti-Poverty Week, and with the high cost of housing and low rental vacancy rates, today our focus is on housing and homelessness. I'm joined by Shane Austin, who's the CEO of Baptist Care South Australia, and he's also co-chair of Anti-Poverty Week. Shane, thank you for your time. This is probably, a highlight in a low-light kind of way, but on the calendar to, I guess, really highlight the important messages around poverty.
Yes, thanks, Caroline. And I'm delighted to be with you this afternoon. And I did find that quite interesting, listen, Adrian, in terms of that DNA. So, but you're right. So for us, you know, as a community, talking about poverty and homelessness don't always connect. So we often think about homelessness in terms of rough sleeping or those that we see in the parklands in Adelaide or beyond. And we often think of poverty somewhat in a different way. And so sort of today our conversation between the two of us is really around how we see those two things where they intersect.
Yeah, absolutely. Can I start by asking the role that the cost of housing and the rental availability in our state and certainly across Australia, but more locally in our state, has had on poverty in the past while?
Sure. And so if I can talk about it from the angle of how there's this downward pressure in terms of housing and homelessness and particularly affordability. So if we think about South Australia, the price of housing has gone up 25% or thereabouts in the last 18 months and rents have also increased. And so as each increase we see in housing prices or rental prices, it makes it less accessible for people on low incomes. So if you think that people experiencing homelessness or at risk of homelessness may have, on average, 40% of those will have less than $500 a week at their disposal, it makes it very difficult. And it, in fact, private rental is really out of reach, let alone being able to purchase housing.
Obviously, if you're trying to make rent or just, you know, trying to, you know, just pay for somewhere to have a roof over your head, something, if you're in a dire situation, has got to go. What other necessities are people missing out on when they try and do that?
Sure. So, I mean, one of the things too is that when we look at the data and the experience of families, and 18% of children in Australia living in poverty, and those families are that are at risk of homelessness or, in fact, are experiencing homelessness. They're going without food, they're going without daily necessities. Often the kids are missing, if they've got children, they're missing out on education and opportunities because it's a day-to-day experience.
How have you seen, obviously, as we mentioned, the cost of housing's gone up, rental availability is tight. Has that been really just exacerbated in the last sort of 2-3 years?
Yes, I think what's interesting from those who are working in the sector and more broadly, of course, because this is a community experience and issue for us, is that there was a period of time within COVID where there was an increase in government supplements and support. And during that time, poverty decreased and it gave people a little bit of breathing room in terms of being able to look for some housing or private rental or some stability. But once that supplement was removed, there was again this sort of rapid increase in seeking support from specialist homeless services.
Yes, and we heard at that time that anyone who was homeless, that they were, you know, hotels opened up, that there was space for them to go to. That obviously was an interim solution, sure, at least for a period of time. Did that help the situation or did it in some ways hinder it?
Well, I'm not sure that hinder really is the right expression, but the way I would look at it is in terms of saying when there's will and when there's a strong necessity within community in terms of that expectation, there are ways in which we can address homelessness and poverty. And so, of course, that was a short-term fix, if we can use that language. But what we need to be able to do is say, well, what are the things that we can do in the long term? So where it inhibited was that it was going to be only ever going to be short-lived experience. And what none of us want to see, either in our own lives or in those that we're working with, is to have an opportunity to get out of that rut or out of that difficult spot and then have to fall back into that. So that's been the experience of a lot of people, and that then has been exacerbated by the increase in housing, which has meant that there are people coming to homeless services like ours and others in the state who may not have been seeking that support in the past.
That was going to be my next question. We've been speaking with different sectors of the community this week around poverty. We started on Monday around food insecurity. Cost of living,
yes,
was yesterday, and today, obviously, with you, housing and homelessness. And it seems, yes, to be that the trend is that everyone is seeing people they haven't seen before. So it's a new cohort. I don't like that word, but a new group of people.
Yes, I understand. I'll be careful not to use that type of language as well, because it's those in the community that work with us and live amongst us.
Of course, so, of course.
As I said right at the outset, is if you increase the cost of living, that's going to put pressure all the way from the top pushing down. So unfortunately, in the way many of us describe homelessness, it's not a system, it's not a particular issue, but it's a result of a number of competing challenges in someone's life or in a family's life. And so I think that as each price goes up in terms of rental or purchase, then you're going to see people that used to be in reach is now out of their reach. So, like, for example, between 2005 and 2017, we saw an increase in cost of average housing for someone on low income of 42% increase in their housing costs.
Yeah.
So nearly 50% increase in the housing costs for those folks in the community that were already finding it difficult.
How can you estimate, I guess, how many people in our state are either facing rental stress or maybe homeless? You know, what sort of figure are we looking at?
Well, if we think, so we can, if we talk in metro and regional, so mm-hmm, outside the city, we could look at a total of around sort of 7,500 people who are experiencing homelessness, and those who are at risk, so those who are likely to lose their tenancy or have unstable housing, of around 9,000. That's sort of 18-19 figure. So I could tell you that we're seeing an increase, but that could be sort of incidental or anecdotal. But that data is quite fixed, because we know that's how many people came to seek service in those years. And so from that sort of data, we're only looking at those who actually accessed the services. So there are those who won't seek access or will try to make their own way. And may not come to us for a service. But for those figures, really, they're quite confronting. And if we're talking about children and children in poverty, out of that group of folks who are seeking that service, we could say that around 36% are 19 or under, 19 years of age or under.
It's heartbreaking, without a doubt. I guess sure. the sad story we've outlined. What do you need? What do you need from either state or federal governments, or what more do you need from community to try and address sure. this?
Well, first of all, I really appreciate you, Caroline, saying around community, because I don't think it just sits purely with a state government or a federal government, but they do have sort of that scale to be able to resolve the problem. But there are two very key elements that we'll see the reduction in poverty. And we've seen that, as I said, through the supplement and other supports, but also to address people who are at risk or people experiencing homelessness. And that's effectively an increase in income support and, goes without saying, an increase in housing.
Yeah, okay. It's pretty straightforward, isn't it? It's just the money and the will and the power to do it. Look, thank you so much, Shane Austin, CEO of Baptist Care South Australia and the co-chair of Anti-Poverty Week. We'll continue our week looking at these issues for Anti-Poverty Week tomorrow and for Friday. Well, we have had a huge shift in how we do things, haven't we? Learning, working, getting entertained, a lot of it's online now, but it's not for everyone because not everyone has a smartphone or a computer or even an internet connection. And those on the wrong side of the digital divide are being left behind. There's around 28% of Australians considered digitally excluded, and that means they don't have affordable access to devices or the digital skills that they need to keep up. Today we're looking at digital poverty as part of Anti-Poverty Week, and with me now is Graeme Jeske. He is General Manager of the Smith Family in South Australia and Northern Territory. Hi, Graeme.
Hello.
It's good to have you with us. Can we just sort of define, I guess, firstly, what we mean by digital poverty?
Well, it's a fun for a lot of students. As you know, the Smith Family works to support disadvantaged kids to stay in school. And having access to internet or a device is now just as important as a uniform or textbooks. So, you know, we now know that if kids don't have that access, they're going to go backwards at school.
So you're starting from really far behind that eight ball you even get going.
Well, that's right. We know disadvantaged kids start school behind, and they need that extra support during their school years to catch up and thrive at school. And we know that having access now to digital is just so important to their future.
And not enough just to get it at school then, Graeme. That's something that needs to, I guess, be available at home for homework, for after hours, etc.
Oh, that's right. Look, anecdotally, we hear families that go to the library in the middle of the night during the cold to access outside the Wi-Fi. We hear that homework's done in a well-known fast food outlet because they have Wi-Fi. So, you know, that's not a healthy way of doing the homework either in some regards. But it's so important for them to be able to access all the school system, and a lot of that is over the digital network now.
Just getting, you know, getting the schooling done, and obviously that learning, that important learning that happens through school is one thing. But what does that mean? I guess the impact of that going forward when we're talking about, you know, further training, you know, building skills, getting jobs.
Oh, that's right. It's fundamental now, as we said. So it's so important that we can help them, first of all, succeed at school, but also gain that digital literacy as they go. And, you know, we have things like learning clubs where we work with our students to try and help them with some of that digital literacy. We have some great volunteers across South Australia, especially our View Club women come and help out as well. But, you know, the first thing that we want to talk about today is, we've launched a new five-year strategy, and we've committed to ensuring that all the students that we support at the Smith Family are equipped with a laptop and have access to reliable internet, which is now a necessity for a 21st century education.
That's a huge, huge undertaking, obviously a very necessary one. How will that roll out?
Well, we've already rolled out around 5,000 since the pandemic, because we saw some real need, especially when kids were locked down at home. Four kids maybe only had one or two devices or didn't have internet access. And I know state governments have been doing a lot of work as well to make sure that kids have access. But we've put out 5,200 digital inclusion packs, and our aim is to continue that work, partnering with organisations, corporates, governments to try and get that out. Because we're also growing the number of students that we're helping. You know, our goal is to grow our reach from around 60,000 to 100,000 over the next 5 years, and to make sure that each child is digitally connected. So you can see that's a huge goal. Mm. Unfortunately, we never have an issue getting students on board that need our support in the areas that we work. That's why we're always seeking more sponsors to support our children, so that we can build our reach even further.
And are you looking at a particular age group, Graham, or is it one age group more in need than others?
Look, I think it's across the whole primary and secondary, but not surprisingly, during the pandemic, we did target the older groups, where having access to the internet and laptop was really important. So a lot of our team were contacting families, and we were making sure we were getting it to the students that needed it the most for their schooling, but our aim is across the board. So probably secondary is a big priority, because that is so fundamental now to their studies, but our aim is to get a laptop and internet connection access for all our students that we support.
And have you noticed a change through the pandemic? We've talked a lot about this, how the profile of people who are needing assistance has changed somewhat. People that perhaps wouldn't have needed your help before now do?
Look, poverty's still there, as we are in Anti-Poverty Week. You know, the latest data in the ACOS and UNIS, New South Wales Uni report, said one in six children, that's 16.6%, are living in poverty. We know that there's extra pressure, and schools and families are reporting that, you know, basic school items, uniforms, books, learning devices when things are tough, you know, lunches, high petrol prices, kids wanting to leave early because they want to get a job and help the family and support the family. So there's some real pressure on kids, real pressure on their finances for families, and just the extra, yeah, you know, we all know now the cost of digital is quite expensive, and it's such a fundamental now for kids' futures.
Did you find that, and again, you know, moving to an online environment for the past couple of years, certainly for school kids was, you know, difficult, and difficult for parents and families and schools, educators to all manage. But was there a group that perhaps were left behind there because of this digital divide, and now that we're returning to the classroom, that you can see that there's a difference, that there's more work to be done?
Look, if they don't have a device at home, then they're sort of playing catch-up a bit at school. But migrant families, we found, yeah, still trying to get the language sorted, then having to deal with digital literacy as well. So we find that a lot of our support was having families come in with their devices, and us helping us out, getting them on online, because you know now that, you know, Centrelink, NDIS, Service SA, motor vehicle registrations, everything's done online. A lot of banking now, a lot of branches closing. So
absolutely,
you actually find that, you know, the pressure is there to continue to be online. And so we do find that we are helping families, and the need for digital literacy is quite strong out there.
Indeed. Graham Jeske, General Manager of the Smith Family SA and NT, thanks for your time today. And yes, absolutely right. Thanks, Deb, for texting in. Says she couldn't even book a COVID vaccination because she didn't have an email address. It's, yes, it's widespread. All this week, we've been looking at the main factors contributing to poverty in South Australia. Here's a little bit of what we've heard. Greg Patterson, Chief Executive of Food Bank SA. What's contributing to food insecurity in SA?
over 60% of people who are food insecure indicated that was that rising cost of living is the main issue. So rising cost of food and grocery, increased energy costs, and then things like housing costs is the other one. Aside from mortgages, there's rent increases. So all of that perfect storm has meant that people are increasingly looking around for ways of trying to supplement their food each week.
What have been the impacts of food insecurity when you're seeing it more broadly in the community?
We've got people now coming in to seek food assistance who have never, ever needed to do so before. About 40% don't see themselves as being part of the charity sector. They've never needed to seek assistance. They don't necessarily need help. A lot of them are just saying, look, I don't have any issues. I just need food. And as the Hunger Report showed, I think over half actually have jobs. And about 30% have mortgages. So these are people being very careful about their weekly spend, but just can't make it all add up.
Kate Fox from the South Australian Financial Counsellors Association. Kate, who are the kind of people that you're actually dealing with? What's an example of a situation of someone coming to you?
We've had clients who've had to choose between food and medication. Someone who had multiple life-saving medications that they needed to be on was trying to work out which one they couldn't take. You know, obviously they worked out a way to support them through that. But just having to make those difficult decisions is really hard. And there was another example where there was a person living in their car. They needed extra mental health medication, but they ran out of petrol, so couldn't get to the medical appointment. They got charged for the medical appointment because they didn't turn up. You know, it's just this cycle of things that really impact people. And it doesn't have to be a large amount to impact those on the lowest of income. Sometimes those small costs can make a big difference. So it's been a really difficult time for many people.
Shane Austin, the CEO of Baptist Care South Australia. Shane, can you estimate how many people in our state are either facing rental stress or maybe homeless? What sort of figure are we looking at?
For the metro and regional, you could look at a total of around 7,500 people who are experiencing homelessness, and those who are at risk. So those who are likely to lose their tenancy or have unstable housing of around 9,000. And if we're talking about children in poverty, out of that group, we could say that around 36% are 19 or under.
What do you need from either state or federal governments, or what more do you need from community to try and address this?
Well, there are two very key elements that will see the reduction in poverty. And we've seen that, as I said, through the supplement and other supports, but also to address people who are at risk or people experiencing homelessness. And that's effectively an increase in income support and, goes without saying, an increase in housing.
Graham Jeske, General Manager of the Smith Family SA and NT. Can we just sort of define, I guess, firstly, what we mean by digital poverty?
Having access to internet or a device is now just as important as a uniform or textbook. So we now know that if kids don't have that access, they're going to go backwards at school.
Just getting the schooling done, and obviously that important learning that happens through school is one thing, but what does that mean, I guess, the impact of that going forward when we're talking about further training, building skills, getting jobs?
Look, it's fundamental now, as we said. So yeah, we've launched a new 5-year strategy, committed to ensuring that all the students that we support at the Smith Family are equipped with a laptop and have access to reliable internet. And our aim is to continue that work, partnering with organisations, corporates, governments to build our reach even further.
Wow, it has been a big week talking about poverty, and in this anti-poverty week, a super important topic to be pulling apart. Today, we're going to be looking at some of the ways that we can address poverty, and I have some guests with me to talk through those. Firstly, Dr. Veronica Corum is a research fellow for the Centre for Social Impact at Flinders University. Lovely to have you on the program.
Great to be here. Thanks, Caroline.
It is a complex issue, that is no doubt. We've covered a lot this week, as you would have just heard, across a range of factors. For you, what policy change do you feel would make the biggest difference?
Well, I think it's probably no surprise to anyone that it's an increase in the income support payments for the people on the lower end. If you're on the age pension and you don't have housing costs, you're probably going to be okay. You may well be struggling if you do have housing costs. But it's the people who are on the other payments like youth allowance and JobSeeker, and to some extent parenting payment, which is a bit lower than the pension payments, those people are much more likely to have housing costs. Their payments are set much lower. They don't come with the in-kind benefits that the pension does. They're not indexed in the same way the pension is. They affect young people, including families with children, disproportionately, particularly sole parents. And that's why we have so many children in particular living below the poverty line.
It feels like there's a constant fight to have the levels of income support, increased. It's a government issue. We've lobbied in many sectors of the community for a long time. Is there something more that can be done to make it hit home?
Yeah, I mean, the research I do is about what the general public, think about policy change in this area. And we like to think of ourselves as being, you know, the country of the fair go. And people do have a genuine belief in fairness and equality. But when it comes to some of the nitty-gritty of policy change, they don't really want to see, say, single parents or unemployed people on the same rate of income support as older retired people. And we have to ask ourselves why that is and why we don't vote for some of the changes to, say, some of the tax concession schemes that are in place that could help fund an increase to income support payments for those on the lowest levels.
Is collectively, I mean, everyone has a role to play, but does it sit squarely with the federal government?
I think we have, it's a federal government issue. We have to have something on the policy agenda in order to be able to vote for it. I do think if the government thought that this was a vote-winning issue, then we might see more of it. So we do have to ask ourselves why the government thinks we don't, or political parties think we don't want an increase in unemployment benefits and benefits for single parents. If they did, I think it would be more likely to be on the policy agenda.
It's an interesting one, though, isn't it? Because we've been hearing all week, as we've been hearing for some time, that the increase in the people in poverty has grown. And even just from looking at the text line here, people care. Even if they're not a person in that situation, they care about others. So, your point, I think the want is there, but maybe the voice isn't loud enough, perhaps collectively from the community.
Yeah, and I mean, I'd like to see it framed in terms of how this would be funded. And there's actually some fat that the government could carve if they want to fund increases to income support payments. We've got budget pressures. There's, you know, lots of things that we need to spend money on. But there's certainly some very generous tax concession schemes in place that primarily benefit older people, people who are already well off. So things like the superannuation tax concessions, capital gains tax exemptions and discounts for property. Those sorts of things are worth tens of billions of dollars in foregone revenue for the federal government every year. If we cut back those sort of schemes a little bit, we might have the ability to fund an increase in support for the very lowest level people, including the 44% of children of sole parents who are living in poverty. Mm.
I'm speaking with Dr. Veronica Corum. We're talking about some of the ways we can address poverty. Also here to have a chat with us is Simon Schrapel. He's National Co-Chair of Anti-Poverty Week. Thanks for your time, Simon.
My pleasure.
Obviously, this is the increase in income support payments. It's a really a big key tax and welfare policy. What about for you? What are the other ways we can address poverty, I guess on a more micro scale?
Yeah, I think it's good to point out that there are both macro and micro solutions to this. And Veronica's talked about and you've outlined these issues too in terms of where our tax and transfer or our payments policy can be tweaked to improve opportunities for our lowest paid people. And, you know, it was obvious during the pandemic when those payments were increased, it made a very significant difference to our poverty levels, whichever way you assess them or analyse them. So clearly, that's the number one lever. But there are other levers too, and there are levers at a state level. And if you look at where a lot of the impact and pressures on cost of living are, I mean, housing is by far the largest weekly expense for the majority of households. And if you're on a low income, paying over 30%, which puts you in stress, or over 50%, which an increasing number of people are now in private rentals, you're significantly exposed in terms of your well-being. And that's the group that are probably most at risk. And you know, clearly our supply of social housing, but also some of the levers. Some of these are also at the Commonwealth level, the Commonwealth rent assistance, which hasn't been increased, you know, in line with inflation over many years, has meant that it's not kept up. And as the cost of accommodation, and you've had lots of stories on the ABC in recent months talking about the pressures of being able to find rental accommodation and if you do, what the cost of it is. So we're not supporting people sufficiently in that arena. And as Veronica says, we actually give tax concessions to people to invest more in private rental housing, you know, to increase their wealth over time and to give them income streams, ultimately at the expense of the people, particularly on low incomes, that have to use that that accommodation. But there are other levers too. I mean, the state government did increase concessions. You know, there'd be an argument to actually have that more widespread than the increases they made this time around. But for the first time in a long time, we had some of those concession payments increased by the state government this time around. There's a review of the Residential Tenancies Act. I know there's been a call for capping rents. Now, whether in fact that's possible or not, or is the best policy solution, is going to be open to some debate. But one of the areas that we know that impacts a lot on households is the cost of utilities. And we have no doubt that's going to be one of those big increases in coming months. And people are going to get bigger electricity bills and gas bills. Yeah, can we ensure that the properties that people are living in are fit for purpose in terms of being able to reduce their energy consumption? So just having minimum energy efficiency standards for rental properties would make a huge difference to the lives of people on low income. So they're just a few of the other solutions I think we could focus on as well.
Well, that's a great list that I've been writing down just there. Simon Schrapple, National Co-Chair of Anti-Poverty Week there. Jasmine Witham is with us. She has lived experience with poverty. Jasmine, really appreciate you joining us this afternoon.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to share my story.
Can you just describe, I guess, your situation for our listeners?
Sure. So I've been reliant on Centrelink payments for my entire adult life, so that's the last decade. And that's even like during periods where I've had paid employment, because I guess like many young people, I didn't have secure work. When I was younger, my housing situation was a lot more precarious, and there were times when I couch surfed in like really unsuitable places. I also have a disability, and during the period I was on JobSeeker, it was incredibly hard to meet the mutual obligations required of me, and disability employment services were completely inadequate for actually finding a job. Eventually, I made an application for the disability support pension, and that process was very difficult. It was demoralising and a bit stigmatising as well. And like, while ultimately my application was successful, it was a really big burden to have to navigate that system without any real advocacy or advice. So I'm grateful to be getting a higher rate of payment than JobSeeker or Youth Allowance, but it's still critical that it's not a sufficient payment to be living on.
Sorry, you go.
Yeah. Well, I guess like now my situation's a lot more secure than it used to be. So I'm a part-time student. I study public health and epidemiology, and I live in a stable rental in the inner suburbs. But like, cost of living and the very low rate of welfare is making things hard, because like my rent is just over 35% of my weekly income. And by the time I've paid my other fixed expenses, I don't have a lot of disposable income to spend on anything else.
Yes, and that goes to what Simon Schrapple was just saying, that it makes up such a, that housing stress and cost makes up such a big chunk. We've got to head to the news at the moment. Jasmine, would you be happy to stay with us? I'd really like to chat to you a little bit more about your experience. Jasmine Witham there. We're talking in Anti-Poverty Week today about ways to address poverty. We've touched on a variety of types of issues this week, from food security to the cost of living. So we'll continue that conversation after the 3 o'clock news. Just before the news, though, we were speaking about Anti-Poverty Week. We've been in our series on Anti-Poverty Week all week. We've been talking about the different aspects of poverty, from food security to the cost of living, housing and homelessness, and digital poverty. And today we're focusing on ways to help those who are in poverty. Jasmine Witham is with me. She has lived experience with poverty. Jasmine, thanks for waiting around for a little bit. It'd be great to talk to you just a little bit more about your experience. So you were saying before you are on a disability pension, you're also studying part-time and you found yourself in some comfortable and permanent accommodation now. What have been the things that have helped you over the time to find your feet?
I think, like, for me, being able to access affordable healthcare, like, for my disability has probably been the biggest thing that's been, like, given me a chance of stability. I still think, like, my income from DSP is still too low and, you know, I still experience food insecurity and I'm still not able to participate in the community as much as I'd like to. So, you know, there are some things that have helped, but that's largely been through being able to manage my illness better. And I guess, you know, higher income has helped with that, because for a lot of people, being able to visit a GP or a specialist or an allied health professional like a psychologist is just too out of reach because of enormous gaps. So a higher income does help to manage my illness.
Yes, so prior to the news, we were speaking with a couple of our guests looking at the micro and the macro solutions that can help. Mm-hmm. And one of those was certainly the increase in the income support payments, which I guess for you would certainly ring true. And that's on a federal level. On a state level, probably the biggest thing that Simon Sharple was talking about was support in finding accommodation and concessions around that. Would you agree, for those that you know, that would also be of great assistance?
Yeah, I think, like, echoing what they've both said, and of course they're the experts when it comes to research and policy in this area, but for those of us who are, like, living it, we'd absolutely agree that probably the single biggest thing that could help us is to raise the rate of Social Security payments above the poverty line to, like, allow us not to spend such unsustainable chunks of our income on rent. And then to be able to afford things, like, because cost of living is rising for everybody, and especially us, like, it's very difficult. So that would be the biggest change. But then I guess what Simon had been saying about access to housing through either more public and social housing or having more protections for renters, because, you know, we're in a precarious position where we're not certain that at the end of the lease we'll be offered the lease at all, or if, like, the rent will be increased to a point where we can no longer afford to live in a place that may have become our home. And then, you know, with that notice being only 30 days, that's insufficient in this market to find somewhere new. So greater protections and rights for renters would really, really help to feel a bit more secure and not as stressed with not knowing if you have somewhere to live and if you're going to become homeless in a month's time.
Oh, absolutely. There's lots of support for you on our text line. One texter says, "So many of us are in deep solidarity with you, Jasmine. How did we get to this state of greed and selfishness? It's time for us to stop lamenting the lack of action and start collectively with some collective action." There's also some pointed questions, and I wondered whether this is something that you have experienced or heard throughout your time. Some people suggesting that, you know, they've worked all their life, and why should they be the one to pay to alleviate poverty? It's difficult to hear that in a society where I know we're all struggling at the moment through the cost of living and other things. But for you, Jasmine, how do you respond to those kinds of questions and claims?
I haven't really met anyone in the community that objects to someone like myself who's on a disability pension receiving that, or somebody on an age pension receiving that. It seems to be more pointed towards people who are unemployed. And I think just a point to that is that when income support payments were increased and pretty much doubled during the pandemic and the mutual obligation scheme ended, more people found employment, sometimes in different industries, but more people were finding work during that period than they have at any other time. So it's like keeping people at such a low income and in poverty is making it harder for those who are unemployed to find work, and it's making it harder for them to do anything. So it's like, how can you find a job when you're worried about being able to afford food or medication? Like, so So if the objection is to people, you know, supporting people who are unemployed, and I don't agree with that personally, but like if that's the objection, it's like, well, less people would be in that position if we actually supported them and lifted them out of poverty, so that while they're looking for work or looking for other things, then they actually have a bit of a breathing space, and it actually does become a safety net for those people, especially when so many people on JobSeeker, like myself when I was on it, have a disability, and finding permanent full-time work that suits their medical needs can be very difficult. So, yeah.
We really appreciate you responding to that, and also for sharing your story this afternoon. It sounds like mm-hmm. you are doing well, and we really appreciate it. Jasmine Witham, thanks again.
Thank you for having me.
Jasmine Witham there, who has lived with poverty, and it's great to hear from those who are on that front line. Thanks to everyone who texted in on that.